Abram Loft joined the Chicago-based Fine Arts Quartet in 1954. He was 32 years old and replaced the second violinist. For the next quarter century, they played concert halls from Chicago to Paris and from Manhattan to Melbourne. They also made recordings. Abram Loft reflects on his life in chamber music in a new book, How to Succeed in an Ensemble. On page 69, there is this entry. When recording, he writes, musicians have to deal with the feelings that every sound they make may be held against them in perpetuity. Abram Loft is in the studio of WXXI in Rochester, New York, where he is the Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Music at the Eastman School of Music. And he joins us, Mr. Loft. It's a pleasure to meet you via the airwaves and listen to this Beethoven that you recorded how many years ago?
It was recorded in 1957.
Tell us how this was recorded.
In that year, we were doing our first set of programs for National Educational Television, which was a precursor of PBS, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And that was a series on the Beethoven quartets.
The Fine Arts Quartet has come again to the studios of WTTW in Chicago to make a television recording of a Beethoven quartet. The Fine Arts Quartet, the first violinist, Mr. Leonard Sorkin. The second violinist, Mr. Abram Loft. The cellist is Mr. George Sopkin, and the viola player, Mr. Irving Ilmer.
We did six hour-length programs. Half of it would consist of discussion and demonstration. It was a script that I wrote. And then the second half of the program was a straight-through performance of the work that we had been discussing.
Given that you've written, musicians have to deal with the feelings that every sound they make may be held against them in perpetuity, do you listen to some of the recordings that you made, lo, those many years ago with the Fine Arts Quartet?
Yes, I listen to them with pleasure and with a feeling that we were young and foolish and determined, because I find that the tempi are not only appropriate, but they really pelt along down the track, especially in a movement such as the one that you're playing now, the presto from the C-sharp minor. That's an interesting psychological ploy, I think, on Beethoven's part, because it's written almost completely in quarter notes, and yet it goes at such a fast clip that you think you're hearing fairly galloping 16th notes.
Part of the reason, the raison d'etre of this book is to let us know how things work within a quartet. Things like, first of all, how you come to choose members of a quartet, choosing repertoire, lots of different elements that come in together. You wanted to subtitle your book, Life in a Musical Submarine?
I mentioned that subtitle in my preface, but I immediately apologize for it because I think it might offend aficionados of chamber music. However, there's a certain closeness, not certain, it's definite closeness that exists between the members of an ensemble. You spend an awful lot of time together, teaching together, recording together, traveling together, rehearsing together. It can get a little claustrophobic since there are is only one player on a part in an ensemble. In effect, you have a collection of soloists, and people who are of solo caliber almost by definition have or should have very strong musical convictions. You know, in a quartet, when you get four people with strong musical convictions together, the fur can fly.
Your submarine metaphor, I think, actually would work with a small group of people that even work together, you know, where you say, try not to fight for control of the rudder and come up for air as often as possible.
Yeah, I think it's crucial. My friend George Sopkin and my long-suffering colleague, he said that ensemble has all the attributes of marriage and none of the pleasures. I think the idea is to make sure that you get some of the pleasure along with the attributes. And it means being a little careful in the choice of the colleagues that you're going to live with over the years. It means cooperation. It means a little psychology and tact and so forth, just as in marriage. When I hear people who have been married a zillion years and they say, how do you account for this? They say, never a cross word. I don't believe it. I don't believe it. There are cross words, but they have to be put to good use.
How then do you create the best sound for the ensemble using these three, four egos, these individualists, these soloists? You have to compromise, obviously.
Yes. You don't want it to sound like an elephant put together by a committee where none of the parts seem to fit well with each other. The ideal collection of people in an ensemble would be that of four saints who also happen to play. Now, I think that saints are not known for their instrumental prowess. And so it takes whatever saintliness you may have as part of your makeup to recognize that there's more than one way to be right about playing a phrase or a movement or a composition. It's a matter of reaching a compromise that is musically convincing, that reflects the specific personality of your group as an organism, as a musical organism, not as a collection of individuals, and that is faithful, as far as you can see, to the intent that you divine motivated the composer in writing the piece.
How does the recording process affect the internal dynamics of an ensemble?
Recording is deceptive in the sense that there's a sameness about the recording once it's made. Every time you play it, it's going to sound exactly the same way. And the exciting thing, both for the players and for the audience, should be the concert experience, because there, just as when you go to hear a dramatic performance, let's say Shakespeare or Arthur Miller or any worthwhile playwright's work, the excitement is to hear the actual interplay, interrelationship between the characters. There's an excitement at seeing the way that each performer responds to the inflection in the line that has occurred on the way to his part, to his solo passage, and so forth. You hand back and forth the prominent role at a moment's notice, and you have to balance not only your way of speaking musically, but you actually have to balance in sound so that subordinate parts do not overshadow prominent parts, no matter where they occur in the makeup of the composition. The literature for chamber music, and certainly for the string quartet, it's terrific. This is the greatest output of some of the greatest musical minds that Western civilization has provided.
Is it your feeling that chamber music is threatened in some way?
I would have thought so, but I have to repeat something that I say in the book, that a year after I joined the quartet, we were back in New York, and I spoke to the then concerts and lectures officer of the university, and I said, Russell, how about having us on your concert series next year? And he said, well, you know, everybody knows chamber music is dying. This was in 1955, and I said, yes, but I want to play at the funeral. And we've been playing at the funeral ever since. And I know that there's a tremendous interest on the part of young players in entering a chamber music career. And I want to make sure that not only they enter it, but that they endure together and prosper together. It's important for all of us.
Abram Loft was a member of the Fine Arts Quartet for 25 years. His new book reflecting on his life in chamber music is called How to Succeed in an Ensemble. Today he is Distinguished Professor Emeritus at the Eastman School of Music at the University of Rochester. He joined us from the studios of WXXI in Rochester, New York. Thank you so much.
Thank you.